Thank you for the invitation to speak here. So the main purpose of this talk is going to be to explain you what these diagrams mean and what kind of fun things you can do with them. There's like a lot of papers about things I'm talking, but these are kind of the key, I would say the key references to this talk. And like these are the key people that also contribute to that. Ross Duncan is here, and also Alex Kissinger is here. Right. So, in 1932, John von Neumann formalized quantum mechanics in his book Mathematical Grundlagen der Quantenmechaniek. You all know that. You might not know that in 1935, so only 3 years later, after he published this book, which is still basically setting quantum theory as we know it, he wrote in a letter to Birkhoff, a mathematician, "I would like to make a confession which may seem immoral. I do not believe in absolutely in Hilbert space no more." Right? In 1936, those two, they wrote a paper, The Logic of Quantum Mechanics, and many followed these guys and that line of research, and it's fair to say that they all failed. So that's like the historical line of development. But this was like, say, the history of that people start to doubt that Hilbert spaces may be the right tool to formalize quantum mechanics. And von Neumann kind of denounced himself this kind of quantum logic later, did other stuff, introduced von Neumann algebras and all that, very much motivated by finding a different formalism for quantum mechanics. So what's the mathematics of this all? So I'm talking here about Hilbert space stuff. Hilbert space stuff is things like continuum, the field structure of complex numbers, vector space over it, inner product and stuff like that. Why? Why do we use this to formalize physics, to formalize quantum mechanics? Well, you can ask von Neumann why he did it, and he'll say he only used it because it was available. No special reason other than that. And you can now go to talk to model theorists and people like that, and they say, oh, you can do anything with complex Hilbert spaces. Whatever theory you give me, I'll formalize it in it. So ultimately, this Hilbert space stuff comes with very little conceptual content. And then you can ask, so what else could or should one use to formalize quantum mechanics? Well, what's the physics of all of this? So von Neumann crafted this quantum logic because he wanted to capture the notion of superposition. He really thought superposition was key to quantum mechanics. So that's why he crafted this framework of quantum logic. The main idea of quantum logic is if you take the supremum of two things, then actually you don't just get these two things. You get a lot of other stuff, which are the superpositions. And in order theory terms, this means that you're dealing with a non-distributive structure. So quantum logic is all about non-distributive lattices and things like that. Two operations, N and OR, which don't distribute over each other. Now, Schrödinger, in 1935, around the same time, he said that the stuff which is the true soul of quantum theory is how quantum systems compose. And I don't have to tell this here, but quantum computing very much confirms this, that looking at compound system is really what actually made, say, the quantum information revolution. Now, on the other hand, 75 years later, as I already mentioned, Birkhoff and Neumann quantum logic still fails to elegantly capture composition of quantum systems, and there's not much else neither, so we can basically forget about that, I think. Right, so what is the game plan? We want to do something new. The game plan is first to solve this equation. So we want to look at the tensor product structure in Hilbert space, because that's what captures compound systems. But we want to cancel out all the other stuff, like all the stuff which I mentioned, like complex numbers, continuum, blah. We want to get rid of that, but still retain the tensor product structure. That's the first thing we're going to do. So, like I said, this is axiomatized. Basically, this symbol, we want to axiomatize this symbol without any reference to spaces. The next thing we want to do is like to investigate which assumptions, like conditions, or what structure we should put on this to deduce certain physical phenomena. So the spirit of what we do is a bit different from the talk you saw yesterday. Yesterday was all about getting the Hilbert space back. No, not really interested in that. We want to know what kind of structure we need to put on this stuff to produce physics, physical results which we can observe. We don't really bother too much about getting Hilbert space or something like that along the way. Now we're going to do another thing, because this is a new structure, and you obviously, when you want to evaluate something which is supposed to model quantum mechanics, then you want to compare it to things we know in the classical world. So we're going to ask the question, this kind of interaction structure which we'll find, do we find it somewhere around us in our classical reality? So, well, it makes it easier or more comfortable to live with it, I guess. So, okay, so we've done all that. So I said we're going to do that, so meanwhile we did it. The first outcome, I'm citing Hans Halvorsen here in the editorial of a book, Deep Beauty, Understanding Quantum World. I think this is about to come out very soon. So he refers to, our program as the sheer ratio of results to assumption. So we actually get a lot from very little. That's the idea. So we must be doing something essential. So meanwhile, because like I remember when we were talking about these things a couple of years ago, people say, you're never going to do anything new with this kind of research. So but meanwhile, we got a bunch of results which actually solved some open problems in quantum information very recently. And the key thing about which you saw already a bit yesterday is that the framework which we obtained, so this tensor logic, this tensor language, is a simple, intuitive, but formally rigorous diagrammatic language. And meanwhile, as we saw yesterday, some people have already adopted this language. So one of the things I'm proud about is like I invented that word picturalism, and now so some people start to use the same word picturalism. But recently there was a paper which had quantum picture on topological quantum computing, which had quantum picturalism in the title, I think. Right. So the second, like my first task was to kind of to find conditions on this tensor and produce a lot of physics. So that's what all this is about, and we saw yesterday some examples there too. The second one is like, do we see these structures in different places? Well, here are some examples. So I'll explain what these things mean later. So this is like an old example of a derivation of teleportation diagrammatically. So that's physics. Here is another example. You see it looks all very similar. There is some recent work which we did in the area of natural language processing. I'll talk about this later in the talk. Something I'm not going to talk about is some recent work with Rob Speckens, which again looks very similar, which is about knowledge update. This was actually work which was initially based on stuff which Matt Leifer initially did with conditional density matrices, but we formalized this both for the classical and quantum case, again in this purely diagrammatic language. Okay. Now, finally, to the word logic. So the logic of the Birkhoff and Neumann stuff. Well, the first question we want to ask is, what is logic? What is logic? What is logic? People like to say logic. Well, it's definitely not the Birkhoff and Neumann quantum logic, which by definition is logic without deduction. Because like I mentioned before, you throw away distributivity. And in logic, on the nose, distributivity means deduction. Like the core of logic is like the deduction theorem, which allows you to reason. And that actually corresponds to distributivity. So if you throw away distributivity, you kind of have a logic without deduction. Now, something else which I don't want to refer to as logic is a sort of metaphysical jargon people come up like it's all a little bit waffling and stuff like that, where they try to solve the measurement problem with some weird whatever. So logic is sort of an excuse to say weird stuff. So that's not what we're going to do. We're going to be very pragmatic. So here is a very pragmatic way to think about logic. You think of logic as a structure which is present in natural language. And that's, I think, very much the history of logic. I'm not. So here I give an example. You take, for example, a sentence like Alice and Bob are everything or ate everything or nothing, then get sick. Because you eat a bit. You need to eat a bit, but not too much. So if you eat everything or nothing, you always get sick. Like here is a sentence. Like you can identify each word in this sentence with a logical role, and then actually the sentence becomes something like this. That's what people do, and that's what people use logic for, to like encode stuff. Now, one thing I want to emphasize here, in this kind of encoding of a sentence as logic, is that the truth valuation people are considering is, well, you want to see whether the statement is true or false. That's the kind of thing people are interested in. So usually you evaluate such a sentence into the set 0, 1. So, and then you say, yeah, the sentence is true or the sentence is false, which obviously doesn't give you the meaning of the sentence. If you say the sun shines, then this is not true. true is not equal to the sun shines, even if the sun shines is true. But the sun shines tells you a little bit more information. If we communicate, we don't say true, false. We say other stuff. So there is more to language than true and false. Right. Here is a completely different pragmatic view of logic, which is that it lets machines reason. This is like where people actually at the moment, I think, really use logic most. And you could call this the soft incarnation of AI in robotics, where people are not trying to reproduce a human mind, but just use logical means to make machines reason to a certain extent. And there are very important areas in computer science, like automated theorem proving, which is used to verify whether programs work correctly. And a more recent, like so more ambitious thing is automated theory exploration. That's like the idea that you give a theory to a machine and the theory spits out theorems. And this might sound like science fiction, but you can actually go online to this site, TheoryMind, which is from a bunch of guys in Edinburgh. And they have developed like very serious technology where you actually, given certain mathematical formulas, actually the machine produces theorems. It invents theorems. It doesn't just prove them. It invents them. And they have started like this to kind of publicize their work. They have this novelty gift thing where you pay £15 and then you give them a name and then they give you a theorem which will carry that name. So once they gave a talk in Oxford and then they gave me a certificate. Here is Cooke's theorem. So this was a new theorem with my name on. I didn't prove it, but it's mine anyway. So this is like a group in Edinburgh. Actually, our framework appeals to both senses of logic. So I think this is the first time we can really say that we're doing something which you could really call quantum logic, because it's really in both of these pragmatic senses of logic. So in the sense of language, we actually did work on natural language processing, and I just mentioned that this view of language in terms of logic, which I gave you in terms of true and false, like we kind of gave a theory of language which doesn't give true and false, but which really assigns meanings to things which you can work and which you can use in practical applications, completely based on these quantum interaction structures. So it came out of that. That's why, like new scientists, that's why they called it quantum linguistics, although it's... right, and then automated theorem generation. Actually, it turns out we're working very closely with these guys of Edinburgh who have produced this theorem spitting software. And there's two guys here in the audience, Ross Duncan and Alex Kissinger, and they developed a piece of software specifically for reasoning about the graphical languages which we use to model quantum mechanics. And at the moment, they're trying to really use this theorem generation tools to actually hopefully soon spit out theorems on quantum mechanics for free. So this is still ongoing, but Alex Kissinger has a poster on this stuff in the poster session. Right, so let me now start to talk about this graphical language. So what is basic tensor logic? So this traces back to Roger Penrose in the early 70s, where he started to use diagrammatic language to write down tensor networks. But it actually only became a rigorous mathematical discipline with this paper of André Joual and Ross Street to actually connect it up, diagrammatic language to actual syntactic mathematics, such that you can actually see whether a certain mathematical theory, say Hilbert space formalism or whatever, or set theory, matches a certain diagrammatic theory. So you need a bridge there between concrete models and diagrammatic language. And that's what they established. So the data of tensor logic, we sort of already saw this yesterday, is like you have boxes with input wires, or an input wire and an output wire, and just immediately, so we interpret these wires as systems and the boxes as processes, and then immediately you see that you encompass the idea of a tensor structure, like what I said, the Schrödinger idea, that the tensor structure should be at the basis of the theory. Because if you write one wire, you're talking about one system, but you can write a number of wires, and then you're actually talking about a bunch of subsystems. So your tensor is living here already, you see, because you can put wires side by side. Or you can just put no wire, too, which, for example, if you've got a preparation procedure, then you don't really care where your thing is coming from. You just want to know what you have to act upon.
Right.
So the connectives of tensor logic, like ordinary logic as AND and OR, what are the connectives of tensor logic? One connective is what I call the sequential or causal or connected composition. Sequential because you first do F and then you do G. So that's like you get a sequence of operations. Connected because there's a little connection in the middle between them, because the output of one feeds into the input of the other. And you can also call this causal composition because in a way F is in the past of G, so it might influence. So there is a poster by Raymond Lull about the kind of causal interpretation of these kind of categories. So the other one would be the parallel composition where you do process while you do another process. It's kind of a-causal. You can think of these things as spatially separated if you want to. And it's disconnected, you see? They are not connected. I'll tell a bit more about this connection and disconnection later. But like, see, it's very, you just got two modes of composition, one in which you connect things and one in which you just put things side by side. And the operational interpretation is you can think of the, like we saw yesterday, like you do first a certain operation and then you do another operation, you do an operation while you do another operation. So is this merely a new notation? It looks all very stupid. Well, consider the following formula. So now you can, now you're allowed to think of this as like the Hilbert space tensor. Think of H, K, H, K, F, and G as linear maps and circle as composition of linear maps. Then this is actually a valid statement. This is a valid statement about linear maps. It's always true. Let's see how this translates to the diagrammatic language. So here we see K after H, K after H, G after F, G after F, and we put them side by side. We look to the other side. We put F beside H, we put F beside H, G beside K, G beside K, and then this bit before that bit. And oh wonder, we get a tautology. So we don't just dealing with a different notation here. That was partly the comment I made yesterday. When you're drawing diagrams like this, you're implicitly carrying a lot of mathematical structure. Actually, if you start from the perspective of, like, say, certain mathematical theories, like set theory or Hilbert space theory, the number of axioms which is implicit in writing these things diagrammatic is actually infinite. It's an infinite number of axioms. Then some people came up with some smart theorem which proved that actually the infinite number of axioms in some clever way can be reduced to a finite one. But it's still a big, big, big amount of axioms which you're actually carrying along just by writing things like that. For example, this particular one, together, here is chalk, this particular one together with the idea that if you have a box and you compose it with the identity, which is just a wire, that you get the same box, leads to something which you can write like this. It's, of course, very intuitive. It means like if I do an operation F first on one system and then an operation G on another system, or I first do the operation G on the other system and then this operation F on this system, this should be equal. This is kind of implicit in this diagrammatic notation, and I made a comment yesterday about that. If you think of a theory where you've got matrices valued in quaternionic numbers, this is not true. This is not true. So it's very easy to come up with things where this is violated. So when you're just assuming these operational evident things, you're actually imposing a lot of constraints on your theory. So it's fairly... It's a powerful thing just to write down pictures. It comes with a lot of structure. Anyway, that's the main point. Now, so what is the logic of, for example, and there is some logic in this equation. Like here's a peeled potato and then fry it while clean carrot and then boil it. You can do the experiment, just do it. And then peel potato while clean carrot and then fry potato while boil carrot. My claim is that you get the same thing. So this is very much like a distributive law, you see? It's some logic which is implicit in this ontological diagram. Right, so now, going back to, like, what is sort of the paradigm? If you now want to build a theory using this kind of logic, what is the kind of paradigm? It's sort of all about having connected stuff versus disconnected stuff. because you've got these two ways of composing, and one connects things and the other one disconnects things. And people like, yesterday we heard a lot of talks about like information theoretic foundation, of physical theories. Well, in a certain way you could say that this is also like a digital paradigm, like information paradigm, but it's not really about information content, it's about information flow. Like you could say like that zero stands for no information flow. There's no information flow from F to G because they're disconnected. And one stands for information flow from F to G there. So it's really more about how information flows rather than what information, than the information content of things. So it's a dynamical version of what you could say an information theory based. People in computer science are only starting to develop the theory of information flow versus information content, but it's a very powerful paradigm. Anyway, so what we discovered is that from such a stupid paradigm, like connected versus disconnected, you can actually formalize a lot of important notions in quantum mechanics already. For example, complementarity, I'll show this later, how complementarity is just about something being disconnected, and the difference between a GHC state and a double CU state is just about something being either connected or not. So I'll introduce later what these dots mean. This I won't really introduce, but it's very intuitive. It's like, it's a symbol which represents the environment. And for example, being mixed means a process being connected to the environment. And decoherence is something like being connected to the environment via something which represents a certain classical context. And this I'll explain how this classical context emerges if I have the time. So, okay, I'll be quick on this one because I think most people in the audience have seen this one. So here you got something without an input and with an output. We think of this as a state, an input, no output. We think of this as an effect. You can compose them, first the state and the effect. You get something without inputs and outputs. How do you want to think about this? Well, you know this thing, you close it and you find the state. You know this thing, you close it and you find the effect. You know this thing, you close it and you find this. So basically what we're dealing with here is like direct notation extended in two dimensions. And that's the way we're going to treat it. So if you have a cat, you want to turn it into a bra, which means, say, putting it upside down. So we're going to assume that we are allowed to put pictures upside down. And we're going to denote this by the dagger or the adjoint, because that's what it's really going to stand for in quantum mechanics. Like flipping a picture upside down, it will be like taking an adjoint. This is a piece of structure which we'll need, which is important. A second thing which you want to articulate, because this is all about tensor logic, and we know a key thing in quantum mechanics is the two systems are not defined by the state of each. So there is something that a quantum state of two systems cannot be decomposed, in two things. So quantum means you can't decompose it. So what we're going to do, we're going to throw in a parallel collection between systems in our language. Like this system is connected to this. You see, this is a wire. You can't cut it down in two. Now, so I say you can't cut it down in two. How can you axiomatize that you can't cut something down in two? Well, this is a way to axiomatize that you can't cut something down in two. So I take this bit of wire here. I flip it upside down. I put it there. I put here an identity wire, there an identity wire. And I claim saying that this is equal to the identity means that this really is a connection. Indeed, if it would have been broken, then of course this is not equal to a straight wire. So you see, by just saying that this thing, like before, is equal to a straight wire, you kind of implicitly assert that this is not the case. There is no cut in the wire. Okay, this is my theory. Given this theory, I can prove things. What I'm going to do is, I define this big box here. You see the shape is just a 180-degree rotation of the small box, and this is the internal structure of this big box. I'm going to call this the transpose, because that's the role it's going to play in quantum mechanics, in Hilbert space again. And then it's easy to see that you can actually prove the following equation. Like what we do to get here is, we take this little box inside, and then we take this wire, and we yank it according to our axiom. You see? Our axiom is a yanking axiom. If you've got a bended wire, you can straighten it. Oh, sorry. Yeah. How do we get here? We just hide the internal structure. How do we get there? Again, we kind of yank this wire. So you see, you can slide these boxes across this wire. You see, you slide it, it rotates 180 degrees. That's the kind of thing we just proved. And okay, so consequently we have this valid equation. You can take this guy, you slide it up, and then you yank the wire, and you get this. And then we introduce Alice and Bob, and well, I forgot to do something. Okay, so if we ask that this one is the inverse of this one, you know, asking that something's adjoint is the inverse to it basically means it's unitary, right? So we kind of do unitarity as some. You see, you can express things like unitarity in this language. And so we introduce Alice and Bob, and this is quantum teleportation. Now, this is all nice. Okay, this is one derivation of one protocol. You could ask yourself how powerful is this language and what can you do with this simple language. Now, to answer that question, we need to go to the symbolic counterpart. And these things are called dagger compact categories. And they've been around for a little bit. Without the dagger, they've been around since the 80s. The dagger was introduced by us in around 04 on top of them. And so you can show that an equational statement between expressions in dagger compact categorical language, which is some involved mathematical symbolic structure, holds even though only if it is derivable in the graphical notation via homotopy. So just by taking these pictures I've been playing around with and just homotopically kind of moving things around like I've been doing, you can prove exactly what you can prove in a certain corresponding symbolic language. Now, this is important to have this corresponding symbolic language because this allows you to sort of look at money like models. Like you could ask yourself, like, well, I would like my boxes to be linear maps or completely positive maps, or maybe relations if you want to do model quantum theory. And then these are relations. So you can sort of consider many different models once you go to this algebraic realm. Now, the thing there are many models which satisfy this kind of language which I just gave, these wires and these boxes. You cannot come up with many, many models. And then you think Hilbert space is not special. That actually turns out to be wrong. There's the following, also to me, very surprising theorem, which Peter Selinger proved in 2008. An equational statement between expressions in dagger compact categorical language, which by this first theorem is the kind of pictures I was playing around with, like the pictures I was playing around with, holds even only if it is derivable in the dagger compact category of finite dimensional Hilbert spaces, linear maps, the tensor product, and the adjoint. So on the nose, what you can prove with diagrams is what you can prove with Hilbert spaces. There's a little qualification. Of course, you can only prove things you can express. Right? You can't prove things you can't express. So the qualification is you can prove anything you can express in this language which I just gave. But there is actually a surprising amount of stuff which is sitting there, like the states, operations, effects, unitary, adjoints, projections, Bell states, effect, transpose, conjugation, inner product trace, Hilbert-Schmidt norm, positivity, complete positive maps. Like, there's lots of stuff you can write down in this language, it stirs out. And so the statement is, an equation on these things holds in quantum theory even only if it's derivable in the graphical language. So, right. Got 20 minutes, Mara? Okay. So remember these pictures. So this is the logic of the pictures. I'm now going to talk about something which probably doesn't fit in this conference, but it's just because it's exactly the same thing, structure which we are going to use. So here's the question. So words have meanings. You open a dictionary and you get the meaning of a word, right? Google deals with meanings of words, of course, because they do all smart. If you type in something in Google, then you also get results for synonyms. So they do all kind of smart things. Now, how does Google? There's not a guy sitting there and sort of seeing what you type in and say, oh yeah, that looks like that, so I can return that. There's nobody sitting there. So there's a machine who does that for you. So how does a machine deal with the meaning of words? The kind of model which is now mainly used there is that you've got a vector space consisting of what you could call context words, and then you look at a huge database of text, and then you see how many times the kind of word you're interested in appears in the context of other words. The relative frequencies give you a vector. So basically what they use is vector spaces to represent meaning. And then you can do things like compute the inner product, and if two words are synonyms, then very likely they will appear in the same context, and they will have a very big inner product. So that's how these people, for example, compute whether two words are similar. Now, there's another question. How do you compute the meaning of a sentence? Because we have dictionaries of words, but we don't have dictionaries of sentences. Still, you don't understand what I'm saying here as a long string of words. No, you understand. Well, maybe you do, but there is some other structure there which is important to sort of carry over the information. So the question is, what is this process which takes a bunch of words and turns it into something which we conceive as the meaning of a sentence? Well, you can try what Google does for you. So you type in a bunch of words, and it just has no clue about the sentence structure. You can check that, like play around. Google has no clue about sentence structure because they don't know how to deal with that. Because there's no theory. There's no theory for that. So that's what I'm going to talk about, the theory for that. Well, the answer to what is mediating the meaning of words into language, into sentences, is obviously grammar. So we need to find a kind of way to make grammar control the interaction of the meaning of words. So just to give an example now of the meaning of how we want to think of the word, meaning of word, here is a verb. A verb takes in an object and a subject and spits out the meaning of a sentence. If you think about it, that's what a verb do. Like, Alice hates Bob. So the verb is waiting for Alice, the verb is waiting for Bob, and then evaluates, yeah, she hates him. So bang, that's the meaning of the sentence. Now, obviously, we're again in a situation that this thing is not disconnected, because if this would be disconnected, it would mean that, well, this hates this independent of who they are. Everybody just hates everybody, which is. So fortunately, we don't have this situation. Okay, now, here is the remarkable thing. So how do you model grammar? Well, you ask a guy, Jim Lambeck, who actually has been around in this area since the 50s. He's the one who actually wrote the first mathematical theories on which Chomsky then elaborated later. He came up in 1999 with a new model of grammar, which looks like this. Hey, we've seen that one. The key difference here is that the tensor is not what is called symmetric, but that's like a subtlety, because words, of course, the order is important. Well, so basically, the way this kind of works is as follows. If you got a noun type, say N, and then you can produce a verb type by just composing something which is the sentence type with something you can consider as the inverses of noun type, which means a verb wants to get the inverse, wants to get a noun. And so once it gets the noun and is multiplied with it, then these two things cancel out. It's like a group with, like, you see a left side and a right side inverse. That's the kind of thing we're dealing with here. And you see these things cancel out, and you get the type of sentence. Now, the way to look at this diagrammatically is, here you got this verb type, here you got a noun, there you got a noun, and you can then use the caps to cancel this out, and what comes out of the wire is the sentence type. And we use this idea now to produce a model of meaning, a model of meaning of sentences. Like, basically, you got here the meaning of a word which flows to this wire. This meaning flows to this wire. They interact here and produce the meaning of a sentence. That's our idea. So this is the grammatical structure, and here is the meaning of the words, and we hope that this produces something which is kind of represents the meaning of a sentence. I'll give you an example of how something like that. Alice does not like Bob. So I can't explain why these wires are there, but you just open a grammatical book on grammar, and they will tell you that that's the kind of structure you have to put this there for this particular words. Now, does and not are kind of logical words, right? They're kind of logical words. So we're not going to do this trick with checking big libraries to find the meaning. We just stick in some wires, because does actually does nothing. So we just make the information flow. Not, well, we stick in a NOT gate. Hey, we know NOT gates. We stick in a NOT gate there. And then we do our yanking thing. Whoop, whoop, osh. I killed some slides I didn't want to. Wait, let me. Damn. Now, well, I can do this on the board. So you see, you got here, you start with Alice, you got this wire, which feeds into like, you got Bob, which feeds into like, and then like spits out something, but then negates it, and that's the meaning of the sentence. See? So, and that's exactly what it does. And then you can simplify it, but you can really read how the words interact in the sentence. I mean, now, this is a lot of blah, blah, blah. So a PhD student at Edward Stef and Mernush Sadrazadeh, they did experiments with these things. They know a lot more about, and they basically blew away all existing methods for something which is called word disambiguation. What this means is if you got some sentence like, what is Alice saw Bob with a saw, now you want to know that these two saws are different things. And that's like a natural language processing task. So they used our theory, these two, and these are their results, and these are all the other existing results for all existing techniques to do something like that. So this is good. Right. So you don't want to make any physical, metaphysical connections here. So we got this analogy that like states kind of correspond to meaning of words, and measurements are a little bit like grammar. But the main thing is that these are completely different things, but a kind of logic is the same. It doesn't mean that they are the same things, but the kind of logical tool you use to describe them and reason about them turn out to be the same. So it's more saying something about this logic. This logic is just such a universal, general thing which applies to many, many different things. Now, you can play a little bit, this is just a joke, of course, but like here we got things like non-locality and stuff like that as a concept. So now we can use the concept of non-locality there, and then you can look at different languages, and you can, for example, see which is the most non-local language. Well, English and French aren't very non-local, so you see words only communicate with things close by. Persian is very non-local. It's because they had this huge empire so long ago. So they right. Okay. With the bit of time which remains, which is less than I had hoped for, I'm gonna talk a bit about how we actually get more. How we get actually more structure in all of this. So, but I'll be a bit quick here. Like the ideas we want to capture concepts like what is a basis, what is complementarity, and stuff like that. Let me go very. I'm going to skip all that. So, here, this is the thing we care about. So we care about something which we call a commutative monoid. For those who don't know, a monoid is like a group without inverses. And like it's associative, which in pictures look like A. If you take B times C, and then you multiply this with A, or you first multiply A and B, and then C, and that should be the same. That's like associativity, this is like commutativity, and this means that there is some sort of unit. So basically we're dealing with a dot, which has two inputs and one output, and another dot which has one output. And this is if you would want to formalize a group in this language, you would do this the same, but then you would have an additional requirement on inverses, which would be something, which would be an additional little box which inverts the input, for example, right? So this is how you model, say, a monoid. Now you can turn these pictures upside down, and then you get a concept which people call a co-commutative comonoid. Now, there aren't very many of those. Actually, it turns out that if you look at sets and functions, there is only one comonoid around, which is the one which actually takes something and copies it. That's like an example of a comonoid. There aren't many. On the other hand, if you go to a category like vector spaces and linear maps, then for each monoid, there is a comonoid, because you can just take the adjoint, and all these equations will be preserved. And the guys we are really interested in are things which are called commutative Frobenius algebras. So you got such a monoid, you got a comonoid, and then you got an additional equation, this kind of very weird equation. And the reason we really, really care about them is that we proved the theorem, which says that if you got such a commutative Frobenius algebra and you ask for the monoid to be the adjoint of the comonoid, which I express here, and then you ask some other equation, which I express here, like a loop is equal to the identity, then such a thing is exactly the same thing as an orthonormal basis, which may sound totally science fiction to you, but basically what you do is, like, this thing is a linear map. This thing is a linear map. And what I can then look at is I can stick in a vector here, a state. I can see what comes out. And it turns out that the things which are copied, like if I got a state psi, then I apply this and I get psi psi, that those things always form an orthonormal basis for any algebraic structure of this kind. So this is kind of a diagrammatic way to formalize what the basis is. Now, once you know what the basis is, then you're well on your way to formalize a lot of quantum mechanical stuff, of course, because if you've got bases, you've got observables, and so on, and a lot more. Now, I showed you all a bunch of equations like this. It turns out, of course, that these equations all together give, again, a nice graphical characterization. It turns out that all these commutative Frobenius algebras I talk about have some kind of normal form, in the sense that they only depend on the number of inputs and the number of outputs and the number of loops. Now, in this equation, which I wrote down here, it tells me if I've got a loop, I can throw it away. And then basically, you get something which we call spiders. A spider is a thing with a number of inputs and a number of outputs, and if two spiders meet each other, then they fuse together in a single spider. That's what a spider is. So I got some news for you. This is exactly the same thing as an orthonormal basis. This is exactly the same thing as an orthonormal basis. May sound weird, but it is. So bases are spiders. Right. You kind of see, well, let me skip this. This is not that important. Now, once you got the notion of bases, then of course, from the point of view of quantum mechanics, you want to know what are complementary bases or unbiased bases. And Ross Duncan, who's here, and I, we proved the following thing, that on the nose, if you think this is an orthonormal basis, you know, this green dot. It doesn't look like one, but it is one. This is an orthonormal basis. And if two, and we call them spiders, if a red spider meets a green spider, their legs fall off. That's complementarity. That's complementarity. If a red spider meets a green spider, their legs fall off. That's complementarity. Can you compute with these things? Well, so you go out in nature, you find some spiders. Here I find a green spider, the Z spider. There I find a red spider, the X spider. So what are these dots? They are, like I said before, these dots are, you take an orthonormal basis, and this is the linear map which copies the basis vectors. That's what it is. So, but they generate a whole family of spiders by just composing them. And now, it turns out, if you plug them together like this, you get exactly the C-naught gate. And then you can ask yourself, what do you do if you compose two C-naught gates? So this is C-naught gate, that's a C-naught gate. Red spider fuses with red spider, green spider fuses with green spider. They shake hands, fall off, identity. So that's how we compute matrices with spiders. A nicer example, teleportation. So my example of teleportation before, you can ask yourself, where is the classical information? It was actually only implicitly present in labels. Now, once we've got these spiders, we can now actually encode classical data transfer in teleportation too. So this basically means, like, if you... This is like the minimal bit of structure which you need to... So basically, here you've got the entangled state. There, that's the Bell-based measurement. You can think of these green and red spiders, of course, as the... you recognize the picture, of course. So here are the Pauli corrections, the two Pauli corrections. This thing, I didn't really explain what it is, but it models the environment. So this is actually asserting. You couple this thing to the environment, what flows in here, which means it's classical relative to that observable. It's really like decoherence. You have to think of decoherence of such a thing coupled to the environment. Okay, can we compute what this configuration does? First thing we do is we throw away the rubbish. Then, see, I'm going to just take all these guys and slide them there. And now you recognize our complementarity again. It goes, and then this green dot will meet with this green dot, and everything goes, and blah, 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 we're there. Teleportation. Right? With classical communication. So that's like, here I want to make a point in contrast to the talks yesterday. Yesterday, Lucian and Paolo, they actually write numbers on their boxes for classical communication. They're not part of the formalism. What I'm showing here is like a formalism where the classical data is also diagrammatic. So it's also part of the wire language. So you can talk to Ross Duncan. Ross Duncan, unfortunately, is very lazy and slow with putting this thing on the archive. But they proved like a really nice result in measurement-based quantum computing on translation of stuff to circuit language using this kind of things. Rob Speckens, Bill Edwards, who's coming here next year, and I, we used this language to actually put stabilizer quantum mechanics and Rob Stoit theory within a single mathematical framework. And then we were able to analyze why quantum mechanics is non-local while Rob's theory is local. And it all boiled down to the fact that there exists something which is called a phase group, which... Each spider comes with a phase group. That's just a fact. And And in the case of Rob's theory, this is Z2 times Z2. In the case of stabilized quantum mechanics, this is Z4. And then you can show that one causes no locality and the other one doesn't. So in a way, this formalism we have also allows to accommodate different kind of theories. For example, the toy theory is very different than quantum mechanics. So we were able to do that here and then get some mileage out of that. So there is Alex Kissinger poster on. So this tool we have already. This is like a software tool which you can download, and it allows you to reason with these diagrams. And in the near future, it should start spitting theorems at you. So you can talk to Alex and Ross about this. I think, I'm not going to talk about this because I'm running out of time. We also did an analysis with Alex Kissinger about GHZW states. So I'm just going to show you this picture. If you have questions, you can ask them after. Here I end. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah.
Okay, we have time for a couple of quick questions.
Bob, is there any sense in which the result of Schlesinger that you quoted could be extended or strengthened to talk not just about equations but about inequalities?
We don't know. Actually, I've been discussing that with him. We got somewhere, but not the whole way, which of course would make a major difference. Yeah, so I don't know whether I stressed, but this is about equational statements, but not about implications. This result, what you can prove diagrammatically, is what you can prove for Hilbert spaces. It's not for implications, just for equational statements.
In some of these diagrams, for example, for teleportation, the continuity of the information was left out the random Pauli operations. So, you also needed some communication to change an S-shaped diagram into a straight line.
You're right, like you really need the communication to make the thing dissolve into a straight line. So it does show that the classical information is essential. Yes, I agree. Yes.
So you made the comment, so which part of quantum theory you cannot represent with your thinking? Can you go beyond these two complementary bases? Even for that, you introduce a new degree of freedom, which is a color, you know, green, red. Does it mean you have to go back to some real numbers, like in a quantum, like in a Hardy's talk, or?
I'm not sure. I don't know.
So you show some of the quantum circuits, which involve two complementary bases. How to go to all possible bases? Is it possible to do?
So, yeah, it depends on what kind of problem you want to solve, how much structure you have. So. The thing is, if you've got two complementary bases, then each of these bases comes with something which is called a phase group, which you get for free. And this group structure is, for example, essential in reasoning about measurement-based quantum computing, because you need more than two observables to have a universal computational model. So that you get sort of, I didn't talk about that, but that group structure you get for free, and that was like really key in the analysis of Speck and Stoy theory and comparison to quantum mechanics. Now. There are, like, for example, one example where you need three colors of mutually interacting is a secret quantum secret sharing. That's when you actually need three colors which mutually interact. So it depends kind of on the problem how much language you want, but also on the dimensionality, of course, of the things you deal with. But lots of stuff you can just do with two colors, it turns out. Like the whole of measurement-based quantum mechanics can model with two colors.
Yeah, Earlier on, when you were talking about boiling carrots and stuff, so you showed this example how you had this equation between two mathematical statements which corresponded in each case to trivially to the same diagram. So one way to interpret that might be to say, well, isn't this mathematical language, this symbolic language you write, the wrong language for describing these diagrams? It has a lot of extra structure that the diagrams don't have.
Right. So I agree that actually the diagrams are a thing you want to consider. The reason you want to go to a symbolic language is because we got all these mathematical structures around, vector spaces, Hilbert spaces, and this is the only way you can sort of compare these two. So you need to know, how can I symbolically write down these diagrams in set theory language, which I use to build all these models, groups, and whatever we've been using. So if you want to, you can basically say, okay, let's forget about everything we've ever done in mathematics, and then you can just stick, which is cool, actually. We do everything again with diagrams, and we forget about everything else. Everybody at the university in maths department, just fire them all, and only these diagrammatics people.
Okay, I think we should move on to the next talk now, so let's thank Bob again.